Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, episode number 33, with Dr. Stephen Novella of Yale University School of Medicine, retracting the needle from autism. Welcome, everyone. This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, episode number 33. We are retracting the needle from autism. And with me today is Dr. Stephen Novella. He is a professor, assistant professor of neurology at Yale University School of Medicine. And we're going to be talking today about the recent retraction of an article from The Lancet. And I'll give you a brief overview of that in just a second. Additionally, Dr. Novella, he is one of the hosts of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, a fantastic skeptical podcast. If you haven't heard it, I really suggest you give it a listen. I quite enjoy it myself. There are many other people who have been on the esteemed podcast, and they bring up some wonderful points, and they have some great discussions about some very timely and important subjects. So, this week, The Lancet, a respected British medical journal, retracted a study that was originally published in 1988, over 10 years ago. Oh, 1998. What did I say? 88? 1998, over 10 years ago. So this has been ongoing for quite a while. And in the study, which was authored by Dr. Andrew Wakefield, he concluded that there was a correlation between autism, gastrointestinal disease, and the MMR vaccine. However, after revisiting the study and the facts of the paper, The Lancet and the editor in the editor editorial board and the editor in charge has found that Wakefield neglected to mention some pretty damning conflicts of interest. He used a flawed methodology, and he also violated medical research ethics in his use of children in the study. So the study has been retracted. This study is a study that has been used as a primary argument for people who, with the belief that autism is related to vaccinations. Additionally, since the publication of the now retracted paper, there's been very little evidence, pretty much none, that supports Wakefield's claim. And regardless of all this, public perception is of vaccines has been tarnished. So over 10 years ago, this paper came out. It got a lot of publicity. Public perception has changed, and people have been making their vaccination decisions based on that study and anecdotal evidence. So is this retraction going to be enough to change people's minds? I don't know whether or not it will, and I hope that we can address this and other questions that arise from the retraction of this single study. So without further ado, I want to bring Dr. Novella into the conversation here. You actually blogged about this on your blog. Was it sciencebasedmedicine.org?
That's right. Yeah, science-based medicine. I also wrote another version of that article for SWIFT, which is the James Randi Educational Foundation website. So this is a big news item. So pretty much all the website, all the science blogs that have been writing about this topic for the last, you know, 4 or 5 years covered it pretty heavily.
Now, this coming from the basis of the ethical concerns from what Wakefield did. Can you describe? Do you know like what he did that was ethically of a concern that could have led to the retraction of this paper?
Well, the first thing that came to light was that Wakefield had significant conflicts of interest that he did not disclose. Now, researchers are supposed to disclose any potential conflict that could bias their research, their interpretation of the study. It doesn't necessarily mean that they did anything wrong, but they need to allow the readers, the scientific community, and the public to decide for themselves if they think that a connection with a pharmaceutical company, for example, or some other potential bias is significant. Wakefield had been taking significant amounts of money from trial lawyers who were suing on behalf of parents of children with autism on the claim that their autism was caused by the MMR vaccine. So he essentially is being paid to find a link between MMR and autism. He did not disclose that. Some of the children that were in the study were the children of parents who were suing on their behalf. So also, again, massive conflict of interest, not disclosed. It also came to light that while Wakefield was making the case that the trivalent, the mumps, measles, rubella, you know, trivalent vaccine had some safety concerns, he had a patent pending for an alternate version of the vaccine, which he could then argue would be safer. So he stood to make a tremendous amount of money from his vaccine. None of that was disclosed to The Lancet. That led, in 2004, actually, to The Lancet contacting his co-authors. There were 12 co-authors on the paper. 10 of them retracted their support of the paper. So that was a sort of a partial retraction that already took place in 2004, based largely on those undisclosed conflicts of interest.
It seems to me, though, that, I mean, this has been a really long time in the coming. I've seen so much work done, so many people who have been bringing this information to light for so many years. I mean, 2004, it's 2010 now. It took 6 years to make the retraction. That seems that seems crazy.
That's a big delay. And The Lancet, in fact, waited until after the General Medical Council was reviewing Wakefield's behavior with respect to the study. Mm-hmm. And they basically regulate medical practice in the UK. And after a very long hearing, more than 2 years, they just determined this week also, they came up with their decision that Wakefield acted unethically. He did not act in the best interest of the children of his study. There were irregularities in the way he conducted the study. And therefore, they recommended that action be taken. Now, they haven't decided what that action's going to be yet. That'll probably be a couple more months. But coming on the heels of the GMC decision, that's when The Lancet decided, all right, enough is enough, and they fully retracted the paper.
I guess that seems like a reasonable way to go. Make sure that, you know, the medical community is looking at it a particular way, and then follow in the footsteps, so that they're playing it safe. Basically, mm-hmm. The Lancet has decided that they've taken it, and they're going to follow what the rest of the medical community is doing and not lead the way.
They were certainly very, very cautious in taking any action. I think they waited too long. It would have, I think, been more gutsy on their part if, when the evidence was really all in, that this study should not be part of the official peer-reviewed medical literature, that they fully retracted it. I mean, they had the evidence in front of them by 2004, certainly, if not soon after that. I think they should have retracted it then. But the damage was already done. I mean, the other point is, this is mainly symbolic at this point. It's still important, but mainly symbolic. Wakefield and that study, more how he sold the study to the press, not so much the actual information in the study itself, sparked real hysteria in the UK about the safety of vaccines in general and the MMR in particular, leading to a drop off of vaccination rates falling below what we call herd immunity, the about 90%, where you get to the point where diseases can't spread readily through the population. Once herd immunity was lost, and vaccination rates dropped to somewhere in the 80s, then we started to see the significant return of measles, for example, which had all but been eradicated from the UK, just a handful of sporadic cases.
And we've had child deaths since then and outbreaks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then that has spread to the United States. We have higher compliance in the US because of it's mandatory to get into public school. But every state, pretty much, I think only with a couple of exceptions, have pretty easy exemption laws. And even though the overall vaccination rates remain high, there are pockets of low vaccination rates. There are schools, for example, that are friendly to parents who don't want to vaccinate their children. So what we see is in these communities...
Marin County, right near Petaluma here, is one of those places where the vaccination rate is dropping rapidly.
That's right. And guess what? That's where the outbreaks are taking place. And they're spreading mainly to the unvaccinated children.
Yeah.
Still, even vaccinated children are still at risk. Some people say, well, who cares? If you vaccinate your child is covered. But the vaccines are not 100% effective.
Yeah, there is variation in how the vaccination takes, and sometimes you need the booster shot to be able to have it really take effectively.
Yeah, so to some degree, we all depend upon each other. Mm-hmm. But also, not only is it not 100% effective, it's like 95%+. But also, there are people who can't get vaccinated because they're sick. They may have an illness that precludes getting vaccinated, or they're too young. They're not at the age yet where they should be getting vaccinated. So those are... vulnerable populations really are only protected by herd immunity. And when that goes away, then we see the return of these diseases.
Yeah, I found some numbers in a textbook written by a friend of the TWIT community, Vincent Racaniello. He's written a virology textbook. And in his chapter on vaccines, he has some numbers that with measles, for an infected person, one infected person will infect in a fully susceptible population. That's a population where nobody is vaccinated. One person will infect between 12 and 18 people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so it's a highly infectious, contagious disease. It's one of the top five killers of children worldwide. It causes kids to die, and that's something that people don't take into account because nobody's dying of it here in places like the United States where vaccinations take place.
That's right. I mean, in the West, like the US and the UK, we're spoiled, and vaccines are a victim of their own success in that our generation, the last couple generations, in fact, have really forgotten or never knew what it's like to be susceptible to diseases like measles or mumps or polio. So therefore, people say, well, why should I vaccinate? I'm not at risk for these diseases. I don't see people dying of measles or polio. It's a very narrow parochial view because, as you're right, worldwide, measles is still a huge killer of children. It's a serious illness. That's what our country would be like without vaccination.
Yeah.
But the anti-vax community, the anti-vaccinationists, just simply deny that. They deny the effectiveness often of vaccines.
All you have to do is look at areas of the world where vaccination is not widespread, areas where the healthcare systems are not as built up as ours is, and where children are not getting vaccinated, and you see children dying of these diseases. The herd immunity that you referred to, and for measles itself, the number of people in the population that need to be vaccinated, need to be immunized against measles, needs to be around 93% to 95% of the population.
Right.
That's a lot of people. And so when just a few people start not vaccinating, it's going to make an impact. It's really going to impact things.
That's right. Especially when it drops below 90%. And in the UK, for example, the overall vaccination rates dropped to like 85%. Now they're back to about 88%, 89%. But, that's enough to fall below herd immunity.
It is.
And again, that's an average. We still have pockets of even lower 20-30% vaccination rates where, you know, it's wide open.
Yeah, you just hope that they're just not touching each other. Just don't get near each other.
Well, there are outbreaks that's happening. There was a mumps outbreak in Brooklyn just a couple months ago. I mean,
I haven't heard of mumps in ages.
Yeah, it's like a third world country, you know.
Yeah. So do you think that this is this retraction? You said earlier that it's kind of just what they're having to do, going through the motions at this point.
Right.
Do you think it's enough? Is it going to change anybody's perceptions? I was watching the news the other night, and there was a woman who was working for some autism group here in the Bay Area. And she was like, yeah, doesn't matter to me. It's only one study.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what she kind of used science's logic back on itself, you know, where scientists say never trust just one study.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is true. And it is interesting. And, you know, some of our UK colleagues like Ben Goldacre have made the observation that in the UK, the press really pinned the whole autism and MMR thing on Andrew Wakefield, as if his authority and his research is really what established it. And then when the evidence started turning against the notion that there's a connection, or to the point when Andrew Wakefield's dubious ethical behavior came to light, they then started telling the story that, well, now this is all in doubt because Andrew Wakefield's credibility is in doubt. But this was never about Andrew Wakefield or his one study. It doesn't hinge upon his authority or his reliability. This, our opinions are based upon the weight of the scientific evidence, which are overwhelmingly against the notion that there's any connection between MMR specifically or vaccines in general and autism or other neurological disorders. So, you know, we have dozens of studies now, the epidemiological, sociological, and some, you know, basic science studies showing that there's just no correlation, no matter how you choose to look at it. When countries change their MMR schedule, this doesn't change the autism rates. Depending on when it's introduced, some studies have gone from the trivalent to single valent, for example. None of it has any effect on the rates of autism. If you look at it and say, well, is there a difference between the timing of when children are vaccinated and when they're diagnosed with autism? There's actually no correlation there. No matter how we've chosen to look at it, and it has been investigated extensively, there simply is no connection.
Now, with no connection there, I mean, that gets to the question of, so the monovalent versus the trivalent. So that's with a single vaccine versus three vaccines in the mix.
Right.
That gets at a point that a lot of anti-vax people are bringing up is, okay, maybe we vaccinate, but do we have to do it all at the same time? You know, mm-hmm. is there evidence that, I mean, one of their arguments is that, that vaccinating with this huge load of vaccines all at the same time is a huge insult to the immune system, and that some immune systems cannot handle it.
There really is no evidence to support that claim, that this is the too many too soon claim. Mm-hmm. That is, it has become one of the slogans of the anti-vax movement, but it's not based upon any science at all. In fact, the vaccine schedule, even as we've added vaccines to the childhood routine vaccine schedule over the last 20 years, the technology of making vaccines has improved dramatically. So whereas the vaccine schedule 20 years ago contained hundreds of what we call antigens, an antigen is a specific substance that will react with the immune system, that will affect, stimulate, and challenge the immune system, that now we've pared that down to just a few score of antigens. So there's actually fewer antigens, fewer challenges to the immune system in the modern vaccine schedule than there was 20 or 30 years ago, even though there's more vaccines. Mm. Also, the number of antigens, substances challenging the immune system represented by vaccines, is insignificant. It's a drop in the ocean of the immune challenges that we're swimming in every day. We're surrounded by bacteria and viruses and other substances that can trigger our immune system, and we happily deal with these without any problem. In fact, there's recently been some science suggesting that our society is too hygienic, if you will. We have exposure to too few antigens, and our immune systems aren't getting enough of a workout.
Right. Hence increases in allergies and skin asthma. Problems and asthma. And yeah,
exactly. So the argument that we're overstimulating or challenging our children's immune systems is not only baseless, it may be the opposite of the truth.
Yeah, I mean, there is still, though, the point in there that there's a lot that we don't understand about how the immune system responds to various antigens. So to a bacterial invader, a viral invader, what kind? Is it RNA? Is it is it going to be retroviral? I mean, how is this particular insult taking place, and how does the body react to it, or which right. cells of the body are reacting to it? And each vaccine that we need to create has to be particular to mm-hmm. the particular immune response that the body would normally create.
Yeah, I mean, the immune system is horrifically complicated. There's no question. You know, I do a little bit of neuroimmunology as part of my practice, I'm not an immunologist, but I know just enough to know how really complicated it is, especially like when we try to design drugs that influence the immune system. That's then we really have to understand on a biochemical level and cellular level what's happening. Vaccines, though, are not that complicated conceptually. We're essentially giving you an infection, but we're doing it with something that is either attenuated or inert, a killed virus or just the protein on the outside of the virus. So your body thinks it's being infected with a virus or a bacteria, but it's not a live reproducing organism. So you mount an immune response against it. You develop immune memory. Our immune systems remember what it's been infected with previously. It creates memory B cells, a type of cell that produces antibodies that specifically remembers the previous infection. And therefore, the next time you get exposed to the measles virus, for example, your body has a much more rapid, much more robust immune response to it and knocks it out before it causes a serious infection. That's actually a pretty straightforward concept, and it's, you know, it's a 100-year-old science. It's been vindicated, validated by our updated and more extensive knowledge of the immune system and how things work. The challenge in designing a vaccine is really just knowing what you need to put in it in order to actually trigger an immune response. So the problem is that a lot with vaccines, developing effective vaccines, is that they don't stimulate the immune system enough.
Right.
They don't get the immune system to make a robust enough response. That's really the trick. It's not that you're overstimulating the immune system. It's just getting it to trigger an adequate response.
Just getting it to trigger it at all.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Did you give the body enough of something, of whatever it happens to be, for the body to notice and to go, oh, okay, maybe I should do something about that and to remember it?
Right. Or are you targeting it against the right things? You know, if you target the wrong proteins, maybe the virus changes those proteins with each strain. That wouldn't be a good one to target. You want to target some core proteins that don't change very much, for example, or that you want to target proteins that will keep the virus from getting access to cells or really interrupt its life cycle. So that's the technology of vaccines. But the immune component of it is just you're exposing the immune system to foreign stuff and our immune systems respond to it. And that's about all you really need to know.
Yeah, and in the case of people who are immunocompromised, it is usually not advised for them to get vaccinated because they will probably respond in a really negative manner to vaccines.
Well, if you're immunocompromised and you are vaccinated with, say, a dead virus, a killed virus vaccine, it's not going to hurt you. It's just not going to do anything. You're just not going to mount a response.
It's the live vaccines that we worry about.
If you have a live attenuated vaccine, then and you don't have enough of an immune system to fight off what's supposed to be a mild infection from a live attenuated vaccine, that's when you can get a real infection, as a serious infection, and it would be dangerous. So either way, there's just no point. It's either worthless or unsafe to vaccinate somebody who's immunocompromised. But often those are the very people that need to be protected.
So
and that's why
you get the people around them to vaccinate.
Yes, exactly.
Now, something that people have brought up in the chat room here is the idea of mercury in vaccines. And mercury was taken out of the MMR vaccine years ago.
Never had it.
Okay.
Never had it.
But mercury as an adjuvant has been,
it's
removed.
Actually not an adjuvant, it's a preservative.
A preservative, okay.
Yeah.
But it's been removed in several vaccines. I believe it's the flu vaccine that might be the only one that still has a small amount of a mercury-like substance.
So the chemical is actually thimerosal. It's a mercury-based preservative that has been used for decades in vaccines and other biological products as well. It keeps bacteria from growing. It's bacteriostatic. Mm-hmm. And it's important to keep vaccines from getting contaminated with bacteria. It's especially important in multi-dose vaccines, which is important in third-world countries because it makes the vaccines more cost-effective. Mm-hmm. And fears were raised about thimerosal leading to mercury toxicity in young infants. But, you know, we've learned a lot over the last 10, 15 years about thimerosal. First of all, it's ethyl mercury, which is a form of mercury that our bodies handle more easily, and it's less toxic. We've learned that children excrete ethyl mercury actually more quickly than adults. They They have no problem clearing the mercury from their system between vaccines, so it's not building up, and there's no real cumulative dose between vaccines. The overall dose is well below toxicity levels. But more importantly, we've looked at just, is there any correlation between mercury dose from thimerosal and autism or any neurological disorder? And again, there's been many, many studies showing zero correlation. Now, what you're referring to, Kiki, is that in the United States, the CDC and the FDA decided mainly to mollify public concern that they decided to remove thimerosal from the routine childhood vaccination schedule.
Okay, got it.
Now, there was never mercury or thimerosal in MMR, but it was in some other vaccines that were in the routine schedule. Okay. By the end of 2001, the beginning of 2002, all of the thimerosal was removed from the routine childhood schedule.
And we've seen an increase in autism since.
Now, yeah, so the rate of autism has been increasing, probably due to increased surveillance and broadening the diagnosis, some combination of that. And the slope of that increase didn't budge. It didn't change one iota after removing thimerosal from the childhood vaccination schedule. That completely obliterated the claim that there's a correlation between thimerosol and autism. It's 8 years later.
They were predicting
that vaccine, that autism rates would plummet, and they've continued to rise without a blip. So that, we always say, that's the final nail in the coffin of the mercury hypothesis of vaccines. But the way they wiggle out of it a little bit, which is really very disingenuous. Now, thimerosal is no longer added to vaccines as a preservative, but it is still used in the manufacturing process in a couple of vaccines. And in the final product, there are trace amounts of thimerosal. I mean, trace. You can't even quantify how much there is. It's just too small to measure. So they just say there's trace amounts. Some anti-vaccinationists say, well, see, there's still some mercury in vaccines because of those trace amounts.
Right. One of the arguments people will make is there should be no mercury in your body at all.
Impossible. It's in the environment.
It's all around us all the time.
Yeah, you get more mercury by breathing the air, by drinking mother's milk, by eating fish. I mean, there's trace amount that's left over in a couple of vaccines is so insignificant compared to what you're getting in the environment. And mercury predates industrialization. I mean, it's just part of nature. It's part of the environment. Sure, there's more in our environment today than there was a couple hundred years ago. And I think that, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and other agencies definitely do need to track it. We need to track the amount of mercury in fish, for example, and we do like to limit the overall human exposure to mercury. But vaccines are simply not a significant source of mercury anymore. They never were a source of mercury that turned out to have any health problems. The evidence has pretty much cleared it as any cause of autism or other neurological disorders. That's really a dead issue, but the anti-vaccinationists keep it alive because they don't want to let it go.
Well, maybe eventually they will. Maybe they'll let it go, but they will. Probably it'll move to something else. In terms of this whole debate and where we stand, I mean, there are all sorts of other studies that have been done that have basically shot down the idea that the MMR vaccine, at least, and mercury in vaccines are related to autism in any way. And from what you've said so far, is there any evidence? Have there been any studies that support the idea that they're linked in any way?
Well, you have to break the different studies down into different types. So there are studies that are epidemiological, just looking at people in society and saying, is there any correlation between those people who have been vaccinated, when they've been vaccinated, a dose of thimerosal they received, and the rates of autism? And the answer to that is no. There really is no study, epidemiological study, that shows any correlation. There's a lot of basic science studies. If you look at the way mercury affects neurons in a petri dish, mercury is a neurotoxin. Mercury is toxic to the nervous system. But, dripping mercury onto a neuron is not necessarily tell you anything about what's going to happen
once it's in the body, right?
In the body, in a biological system.
Yeah.
So We never really know how to extrapolate from that kind of preclinical, you know, animal or in vitro kind of studies to what happens to people.
Mm-hmm. And even like you said, the difference between children and adults.
Right. That's right. And so, but as now from looking at it from multiple different angles, you know, it's the consensus of the research that tells us there's really no correlation. Mm-hmm. There are some published studies that do find a correlation, but they're all done by certain researchers who, like the Greer father and Souther team, father and son team, that David and Mark Greer, who have published a few studies saying that they have found a correlation, but right. their studies have been shown to be horrifically flawed. Again, this is sort of a conflict or a campaign that they have on it. Their studies don't hold up to scrutiny, to peer review, and it's just them. It really, there's no one else. The same data gets looked at by other researchers, and they say, "No, you're nuts. There's no correlation here."
and we can't replicate your study.
Yeah, I mean, they're blowing the statistics. They're just doing bad science. But but they again have hitched their wagon to this claim to the anti-vaccine community, the anti-vaccine movement. So, I mean, the anti-vaccinationists are trying to generate evidence to support their views. But frankly, it's all crap. They're not convincing anyone in the scientific community. And when the good science that's getting done is showing no correlation at all.
And moving from there, there's the area of anecdote as well. So, you know, just moving beyond what people say scientifically. I mean, we have science-based medicine. And then we also have what people base their choices on in their everyday life, which is, well, my cousin said, or my sister did, or it's all, you know, what you heard from people you trust, which is anecdote often.
Yeah, it's really easy to scare people, and it's hard to reassure them. And just the way our brains are hardwired, I mean, we're social animals, and we're very compelled by stories. You know, you hear somebody else tell you a story of how they were either helped or hurt by something, and that really moves us emotionally. And it's hard to step back and say, okay, but that's anecdotal, and this numbers on a sheet of paper that the scientists are showing me are telling a different story. That's just not how we're hardwired. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to, you know, be a little bit of a disciplined scientist or critical thinker in order to think that way. And that's what we try to teach people, is, you know, how to think about the data and why you really shouldn't trust anecdotal stories. So, you know, when it comes to vaccines and autism, well, you know, the childhood vaccine schedule, you know, starts in infancy and goes through, you know, 3 or 4 years old. That you know, blankets the period of time when autism is usually diagnosed, or when regressive forms of autism, where children may, you know, actually develop normally for a while and then lose ground and then regress, which is a small subset of autism, that there's this rough correlation with when children are getting vaccinated.
Yeah. So there are several people I know, people I have met through family members, in-laws, et cetera. You know, there's the, well, you know, I know that when the vaccines were given, this is what I saw happen.
Right.
You know,
right.
And a lot of people say that.
Yeah. So, but again, that's just, again, the way we're sort of hardwired to make those kind of observations. We're actually really good at seeing apparent patterns and connections.
Yeah. As a neuroscientist myself, I understand what great pattern generators we are. The human brain is fabulous at it.
But we stink at statistics, right? So this is where we're led to. But interestingly, what autism researchers have been doing is looking at home video of children, and also now some prospective studies where they look at infants from birth and observe them very closely. And what they're finding is that you can diagnose who's going to have autism even at 3 to 6 months old, even very, very young, before they ever get vaccinated.
That's something I've wondered before, whether or not there are signs that parents just aren't picking up on, that there's whether there's something that if you knew what to look for, you could catch it.
Yeah. So That's exactly. And there was the dramatic case is the Cedillo case, which came up before the autism omnibus hearings, where there were hundreds of parents that were suing the vaccine compensation program, saying mm-hmm. that vaccines caused their kids autism. And there were a few test cases that came up. One of the test cases, which was with MMR and autism, the parents insisted that the autism symptoms began after the vaccine. But mm-hmm. in court, they showed the family video of the child, year before the vaccine, and the signs of autism were clearly present mm-hmm. before. And now there's a couple of published studies that show the same thing. You can diagnose autism earlier and earlier. But mm-hmm. parents remember, they kind of, maybe there was something in the back of their mind that they were concerned about, but they didn't really confront it, or they really weren't sure. But then, right. It sort of solidifies in their mind. And then also our memories are very plastic and pliable. So their memories start, and this is not deception on their part. This is really what happens to their memories.
Yep.
It starts to, in retrospect, they clean up the story, where
You can make your memory the way that you want it to be.
Yeah, so they really honestly remember.
Memory is not infallible.
Right, my child was perfect. They got vaccinated, then they were horribly autistic. But that, even though that didn't happen, and that happens in medicine more generally, patients yeah. will just over time, their memory will morph so that they mm-hmm. will line up events and they will attach their symptoms to something they remember happening in the past. Even though when you go back and maybe look at the record, if you have it, they may be a year apart. Two events that they were saying happened at the same time were actually occurring months or even years apart, but they just don't remember it that way anymore. So, scientists understand this, right? This is why anecdotes are misleading and very tricky, and you can't really rely upon them because memories stink, our observations stink, we're bad with statistics, we assume causation from correlation. So I believe parents really believe that their child was injured by vaccines. Of course, there are rare vaccine reactions.
Yeah.
No one's denying that there aren't legitimate rare one in a million type of vaccine reactions where people are injured and they absolutely need to get compensated. And there's a system to do that. But clearly, vaccines are not responsible for an autism epidemic. This is nothing common or frequent going on with vaccines. And those parents that are convinced that there is, I think, mean well, but are victimized by a dedicated ideological anti-vaccine movement and by just the foibles of human neurology.
Yeah, and there's all, everywhere you look for information, if you just put vaccine and autism into Google, suddenly it's just page after page after page of, not very good information. The really good information somehow gets buried underneath everything else that, happens to have the right meta tags.
Right.
Even though
there's a bit of a Google bar going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'd like to get the scientific information highly ranked on Google. But it does seem to be overwhelmed with nonsense. The real science tends to get buried.
And people are probably more likely to trust their friends than somebody they don't know. However, we can get on the case of Oprah and Jenny McCarthy. Mm-hmm. I really don't like bashing people. But it's from where I stand, I think it was very irresponsible of Oprah to begin giving Jenny McCarthy a platform from which to start speaking.
I absolutely agree, and she takes no responsibility for it whatsoever. I mean, she has a massive media presence and platform, and she chooses to give it to the people she wants to give it to, and she certainly skews far towards these kinds of sensational.
Sensational people. Gets better ratings. Yeah. It works. Yeah.
And the science, who cares? And Jenny McCarthy, sometimes people will criticize us for being so hard on her. She's just a mom trying to understand what's going on.
Yeah.
I feel for her as a mother. I have two daughters that are the light of my life. If there was any problem with them, I totally understand the reaction of a parent to having a challenge with their children. But Jenny McCarthy chose to use her celebrity, mm-hmm. whatever celebrity that was, in order to enter the public debate about vaccines and autism. And she is now shilling for an anti-scientific, very dangerous, harmful organization. She has response. She's no longer just a mommy now.
Yeah,
she is a public figure.
She's taken responsibility that's much larger than that role. Yeah.
And she does not have the expertise to do that. I mean, she, and her opinions are, you know, she gets the science horribly wrong. She makes statements, for example, that there is ether and antifreeze in vaccines. It's just factually incorrect. She gets called on it,
yeah.
Corrected, you know, publicly corrected on
and
that.
She's
but
like,
still,
yeah, whatever. Still says, never mind.
She doesn't care.
Okay.
So, you know, she's not doing due diligence. She's not getting the science yeah. right. She's not listening to experts. She's, you know, trying to convince the public to have a hostile attitude towards the mainstream scientific and medical communities. She's absolutely responsible for what she's doing.
Do you think there's a way to get, I mean, I think shows like this and like the Skeptics Guide are a good start, but we're not Oprah.
Right.
Oprah does have Dr. Oz now, who's she's using to give out medical information and health information. But I mean, like you said, science-based medicine, try and get people to understand that we aren't, that we are these pattern recognizers, that we're bad at statistics,
right.
That entire list that you pointed out earlier. How do we get people to understand this about their own human nature and to be able to look past the fear of their environment?
Yeah, I mean, that's the $64,000 question, right?
Yeah.
That's what you and I are trying to do. And it certainly is an uphill battle, but I think we're doing a good job in that, despite the fact that the skeptical community, if you will, is fairly small in numbers.
Mm-hmm.
We have a really disproportionate effect. I mean, just look at the number of science podcasts on iTunes that are hardcore skeptical. It's way overrepresented. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
there's quite a few. We're getting more and more media contacts. Our blogs, mm-hmm. our science blogs are very popular. The top rated science blogs are basically skeptical, mm-hmm. Like Pharyngula and Bad Astronomy. And, you know, now we're trying to, you know, push science-based medicine and other blogs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's getting us a lot of media contacts. I think the beautiful thing about the internet is that when people really want information, they will look for it. So we may not be passively going before millions of people's eyes, but when people really want the information, we're putting it out there for them, and they are finding it. So we are part of the conversation. You know, we are having an impact. We are having an influence, and we just keep need to plugging away. In addition to that, we need to teach the media how to do a better job at presenting science.
Yeah. So when you have an autism story, don't immediately go to Jenny McCarthy.
right. Which they still do, which just drives me crazy.
Yeah.
But you know, we're working on it. You know, we're making media contacts, not only giving them information, but teaching them how to present science information in a more meaningful way. And then the third, I think, arm of all this is science education.
Yeah.
Is horrifically bad and it needs to improve dramatically. So we're also huge advocates and trying to get involved with the conversation of both defending science education from outward attacks like creationism, for example, but also just improving the quality, you know, teaching people more critical thinking skills, not just memorizing lists of facts.
Right. Start from the very beginning in kindergarten. Mm-hmm. Let them stay creative and thinking critically all the way through, and it will help people more when they become adults. Do you think the skeptic community, though, is, I don't know, that there's a backlash against the skeptic community in and the message that the community is trying to put out? Do you think that there's a negative face on the skeptics at all?
Well, I think, you know, the word skepticism certainly has a lot of baggage, but I think we're actually slowly changing that in a positive direction, not a negative direction. And I have definitely seen a backlash against skeptics from the people that, you know, you would expect, like from creationists and from the paranormal community, mm-hmm. And certainly from the anti-vaccinationists. So, of course, mm-hmm. we're going right at them. And I absolutely expect them to be fighting back, but it's really isolated to those groups that we're targeting, those anti-scientific groups. I think that means we're having an effect. They're spending their time and effort to specifically go after us. They wouldn't be doing that if we weren't hitting them where they live. Mm-hmm. And they're also beginning to see that, you know, we are, I think, inspiring some real mainstream attention, like with the anti-vaccine movement. The Chicago Tribune did a series of articles, scathing articles, really lambasting the anti-vaccine movement, did a wonderful job with those articles. So I think they're really feeling the hurt that we're putting on them. So, yeah, there's a backlash, but that's a good thing in my opinion.
Because the backlash maybe eventually creates more conversation and more debate.
Yeah, I mean, again, we're trying to get the information out there. You know, we want there to be absolutely open debate. We want people to be better informed. We want more information because we think that science and the truth are on our side. So of course we want that information to get out there. If people really did see both sides, and we had a real appropriate forum to really fully and deeply expose all of the data and all the evidence, we win, because we're just trying to defend that position, which is based upon logic and evidence. So logic and evidence should lead to similar conclusions to the ones that we're promoting. Whereas groups like creationists and anti-vaccinationists, they're about misinformation.
They're like the tobacco industry.
Yeah, they're really. I mean, back in the day. doubt and confusion. That was their product. That's what their, if I recall correctly, their internal memo said, we're selling doubt and confusion.
Yeah.
And that's what movements like the anti-vaccination movement are all about. But you can only last so long with misinformation. Eventually the real information tends to get out there.
Yeah. And I think people really just want information. All they're looking for are answers, and they're looking for the best way to keep themselves and their families healthy. And so they're trying to find those sources of good information.
Mm-hmm. And I agree. Yep.
It's just about getting those sources of information out there in a way that people are going to trust them the way that they trust their family and their friends.
I agree. I mean, all we could really do is just take an educational approach to try to educate the public, educate the media, improve science education overall.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about science journals themselves. So the journals that where this information is published, or even scientists themselves who are working in the vaccine or the autism, or any part of the healthcare industry or research level part of it. Do you think there's a responsibility there to be open and honest with the public about what's going on with respect to measles, with respect to autism? Or do you think that's the role of just the government or higher level?
No, I think the scientific community needs absolute transparency. I don't think science can work without absolute transparency. Sometimes scientists may fall into the trap of thinking that, well, they know what the answer is, and they need to defend themselves against ideological groups. So, maybe they'll play their cards close to their vest. I could certainly see people thinking, like at the CDC, for example, I'm not saying they've done this, but you can certainly imagine them thinking that, well, we don't want to start any hysteria about vaccines. So, we're going to keep information under tight wraps and only dole it out as we think. But that, I think, always backfires, because when the information does get out, any attempt at even slowing that information flowing to the public looks like a conspiracy. It validates all the paranoid worst things that the other side are saying. So we've seen that with ClimateGate recently, about the whole global warming controversy. Certainly creationists are always accusing evolutionists or evolutionary biologists of hiding any inconvenient information, and the anti-vaccinationists are accusing the CDC and the government and doctors of hiding inconvenient information. So I think that even though it may seem inconvenient in the short term, I think long term, our only option is full disclosure, total transparency, let the chips fall where they may. And we can explain the complexities to the public, but we can't, in any way hide or conceal information because we think it's going to play into the wrong hands, because that would absolutely backfire.
Yeah, and I think that's been proven time and again.
Yes.
Yeah. Honesty and transparency. So hopefully, scientific journals and scientists are listening. The journals, I think, scientists have more of an interface with the public. Scientists often are teachers themselves, teach classes or have the ability to blog or interact with the public through public lectures, any number of ways. So scientists themselves can be a first line of communication. Not all scientists are necessarily cut out for that role, however.
Right.
So I'm not going to say that every scientist needs to, but I think it is a responsibility. The scientific journals, that's another story, because they're this repository of information, mm-hmm. and do they need to play a larger role?
Well, I think they have a duty to do their job, which is to be, in to some degree, the gatekeepers of legitimate scientific
and not
literature.
Let papers like Wakefield's get published in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, they certainly need to have an editorial responsibility to make sure that there's papers that get published have a certain minimal criteria mm-hmm. for ethics and for scientific standards. They certainly need to fulfill their role, which they're increasingly doing, I think, to make sure that there is a full disclosure of potential conflicts of interest. I think they need to respond aggressively when fraud comes to light or any kind of dubious ethics or behavior. They should try to hide their reputation by sweeping things under the rug. They should just have full transparency, mm-hmm. admit mistakes. You know, we all make mistakes. You know, there are thousands of scientific studies get published every year. Tens of thousands. I mean, keeping any fraud or misconduct from leaking into the literature is impossible. All you could do is, when it comes to light, do a fair and honest investigation. Don't do a witch hunt. I mean, we don't want people to engage in a witch hunt, but just do a fair and honest investigation. Yeah. And if it looks like there was wrongdoing, correct it.
Yeah.
Just correct the mistake.
Yeah. And I think that goes a long way. It's been a great hour. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Fast.
I know. This is a huge topic. And I think, beyond vaccines, beyond autism, there are many other areas we could touch on in terms of science-based medicine and just
sure.
science.
Yeah, anytime.
Science
it was fun.
In your life. So, Stephen, can you tell people where they can find you online?
A few places. I think my primary outlet is as host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, which is a weekly science podcast. I also contribute to a few blogs. Sciencebasedmedicine.org is a medical group blog that I have. My personal blog is Neurologica blog. If you just search on that, you can find that as well. And I also contribute to Skeptic blog, which is a group skeptical blog.
I'm trying to bring up Neurologica blog. What was that again?
Yeah, Neurologica blog is it's kind of a mouthful, but Neurologica was already taken, so I had to add the blog after it.
There you are. I'm going to try and bring up a pretty picture. Oh, that's, there we go. Neurologica blog, and you can see here lots of wonderful commentary by Stephen Newt. Novella on, fMRIs in the comatose. That's an interesting one, too. Oh, that's something mm-hmm. else we could talk about.
Oh, that's a huge topic. Yeah, absolutely.
That's a huge topic. I love all that stuff. I love it. So lots of interesting commentary on the Neurologica blog, and there are links from there for you to be able to find his other outlets, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, his weekly science podcast, which, as I said at the beginning of the hour, is a lot of fun. Oh, you talked about dinosaurs, evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Great. The big three, volcanoes, dinosaurs, and what was the last one? Space, I think. You talk about those, people love it. They just love it to begin
right.
with.
Right, right. Who doesn't love dinosaurs? Right?
Who doesn't love
pretty,
dinosaurs?
These are pretty dinosaurs, too.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been, a fabulous discussion, a really interesting hour for me. I hope everyone else out there enjoyed the conversation. Thank you very much for joining us here on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. And thanks, Stephen, for all the information about autism and vaccines and science-based medicine. And make sure you check out sciencebasedmedicine.org, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and Neurologica blog. And if you're in the New England area, the New England Skeptics Society, if you're interested in that sort of a thing.
Thank you, Kiki. It was a lot of fun.
You're welcome. Oops, I pulled up the wrong picture right there. One of these days, I will actually get all of this right. I can see you in the background there. And I'm Dr. Kiki, and that's it for Dr. Kiki Science Hour this week. If you're interested in emailing me about any of the stuff we've talked about today, you can email drkiki@twit.tv. That's drkiki@twit.tv. And you can find me on Twitter, Dr. Kiki at Twitter, and my website, drkiki.tv. All very simple, easy to remember. If you remember Dr. Kiki, just Google it, you'll find me. For next week, we're going to be talking about robots, so I hope you're in the mood for electronics and technology. And in the meantime, tweet me later. Peace out, folks.